I'm teaching her how to use naloxone, just general education around substance use and mental health. And we also do connecting resources. So we have Share With Us Today and Progressive Housing. And so that's, we like to highlight the resources within our community. So that's why we're here today.
Saxon also expressed that despite the positive response that this memorial had been receiving, the Tri-Cities Community Action Team still has concerns over how the toxic drug crisis in BC is being dealt with.
I do want to say it's really unfortunate that we're cutting a lot of the programming that's working. So we went down from, we were at 7 deaths a day a year ago, and now we're down to 5, which, yes, it's a win, but also now we're seeing cuts to like safe supply programs, we're seeing cuts to treatment programs, and we're moving into a more like involuntary treatment approach. And I think we're kind of going a little bit backwards where we should be, and we see what's working, but I think also people are kind of at a, like, they don't know what to do, and there's no cookie cutter solution. And I think what we need to see is a little more wraparound services, more places where people can go and it meets them where they're at, their journey, because it's not, like I said, it's not a cookie cutter solution. There's so many different layers here. Some people, it needs to be a harm reduction approach, they're going to continue using some or they need access to treatment and on their own terms, and I don't think it's fair to push anybody into that treatment.
Lastly, Saxon speaks on the importance of bringing people together when tackling issues such as the toxic drug crisis in BC.
It takes a community. We really need to come together in this, and I think that the opposite of addiction is connection, and that's one thing that we miss. There's a lot of stigma around substance use. People are going to use drugs. We know this. It's not about pushing the drugs away. It's not about getting rid of the drugs. It's about meeting people where they're at and not pushing people into isolation, bringing them back into the community and finding a sense of belonging.
This has been Danny Nazvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby.
This is Ian Gregg reporting for CIFA Radio's Due North on 88.7 FM. This initiative is made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada through the Local Journalism Initiatives Program. Find our news stories online at frequencynews.ca or cfur.ca. This interview is one in a series CIFA Radio 88.7 FM is conducting ahead of the federal 2025 election occurring April 28th. Our aim is to make a reasonable effort to showcase each candidate running in the Prince George Cariboo riding and the Prince George Peace River Northern Rockies riding, which both intersect our community of Prince George Clay-Lytonay. The intention of the series is to give each candidate an opportunity to share their goals and objectives for their respective ridings and give the audience a sense of who these people are. The following has been edited for clarity and brevity. We met in Prince George Clay-Lytonay with Angie Bonazzo, the NDP candidate running in the Cariboo Prince George riding. She works as a mental health support worker for the Northern Health Authority at the University Hospital of Northern British Columbia and is also a labor representative in the work she does there. Do you mind just giving us a little introduction of your professional experience, just a little bit about yourself? Who are you? Who is Angie Bonazzo?
I've worked for the Northern Health Authority since 2007. I started in Fort Nelson, moved down to Dawson Creek, made my way to Prince George. Have always been the low-ranking person in the nursing structure as a nursing assistant. Have worked in a variety of roles in a variety of different departments. Started up at Detox, which is otherwise known as the Adult Withdrawal Management Unit, and it was there that I saw the impact of public health policy on individuals who struggle with mental health and substance use disorders. In the backdrop of that, I am a very active shop steward, highly sought after at meetings, and bargained the last collective agreement, not this previous, or this one that we're in now, but the previous one, and realized the importance of having a strong voice on the Hill to maintain transfer payments going to the provinces to maintain their social programs. So this is what galvanized me to get up and run for the party that has always been for public health care in this country, the NDP.
Various provinces depend on these transfer payments to support things like education, health, basically the public services that we rely on. Is that a correct summation?
Absolutely.
You know, on the left to right political spectrum, where do you feel you sit And where do you feel the party you represent sits?
The NDP sits on the left. These days, though, I would say that the political spectrum, it's not either far left or far right. I think it goes along like a scale. And with younger generations, they tend to pick, as an example, they cherry pick from parties and ideologies that work for them. So this is where you get this fluidity with younger generations along this flexible sort of like idea of where they sit on the political spectrum. I am on the left, but a little more closer to the center of left than far left. I'm not at the edge of the table. I'm more into the center of the dance floor.
So within your experience of healthcare, you touched on a couple items which are pretty interesting. The healthcare system in British Columbia is pretty stretched. ERs, they're not open consistently. We have a shortage of healthcare professionals. On top of it, the toxic drug crisis is claiming lives at an alarming rate. To address those problems, is there something more root you feel could cure that? And is there a few Band-Aid things you could throw on top to ease the pain in the short term? Within the Cariboo Prince George riding, what message would you bring to Ottawa?
In terms of rural ERs closing, this is an alarming notion to most Canadians. I would go so far as to say that if somebody is coming into a rural ER, they're often referred to a higher level of care anyways, because there's limited resources to manage what they require in terms of their health care. So that's not a very good answer, but oftentimes there are ERs open that are in closer proximity to people that can better serve them if they require emergent care. So you get into like this picky thing about, you know, what is an emergency? You know, it's a picky thing and you can only really address that in the moment. I do know that in the north, the larger communities work very hard to accommodate those emergency room closures. In the rural areas, there's also the delivery of like Zoom care from doctors, like from other areas in like the Coastal Health Authority, that's Vancouver, to actually manage and then get people airlifted out to a higher level of care. So I don't know if that's a satisfying answer to your listeners, but this is what we're doing now. Canada's immigration policy, there's a lot of talent, there's a lot of medical talent that are being not put on the work floor here. A lot of issues around worker shortage can be addressed in the portfolio of what we're doing with our immigration and getting these healthcare professionals certified to be on the floor and delivering the healthcare that we need. You're seeing it a little bit here in Prince George, but not to the capacity of where we could fully utilize the talent that is trained overseas. So to address that as a Band-Aid, the NDP is working hard to fix the immigration issues that are going on with trained professionals that can't go on the shop floor and work. Yeah, the toxic drug crisis. So this lands in the province's portfolio of healthcare. This isn't really a federal initiative. There is a lot of criticism around the safe supply that was delivered in British Columbia. A lot of criticism around it. So to answer the toxic drug crisis, you'd have to talk to a BC provincial person because this really is their portfolio. As a federal candidate, I can't really speak to the toxicity of what's going on out there. All that to say, working in that unit, all levels of society are represented with substance use disorder. There's not one pocket of a certain group or a cultural group that is represented in the unit. So this is a societal issue. So where does it go to? Is it because we're lonely? Is it because we're isolated? Did the COVID pandemic drive us into using more? And, you know, you don't even have to be using a toxic substance. You could be doom scrolling, gaming, shopping. There's all sorts of like addictive behaviors. Right? You know, we don't realize it, but we're getting a dopamine hit when we stare at our screens. So, you know, how do you repair this crisis? Well, we can't undo the pandemic. The only thing that we can do is work at, you know, the counseling structures and maybe working as a society so we don't feel as lonely and isolated, because where you have addiction, you have loneliness and isolation. And to alleviate that isolation, you're getting into an addictive behavior. So it's a big, complicated issue. And I hope I didn't muddy the issue by getting into these long-winded answers. But
when we look at the toxic drug crisis and isolation that you're referring to, isolation can also come about with the stigma of homelessness, the stigma of addiction itself. The issue of housing
and the cost of housing and how many people are pushed out of being able to not only own a home, but even just rent a home is also playing a part in these multiple crises. Do you have a perspective on what could help the housing shortage in the Cariboo Prince George Riding? What kind of message would you take to Ottawa? What do you feel would actually help address this issue?
Jagmeet Singh has gone on to promise that we would bring in rental caps because the right to housing has been turned into a commodity. So billionaires that are currently leading the other parties have exploited renters with their exceptional rents. So the NDP is on the books to fight that. The British Columbia NDP have built and bought hotels to accommodate some of the marginalized individuals that are experiencing homelessness. On a national level, though, I don't know if landowners would be really accepting of a rental cap, right? So you've got a battle there with the entrepreneurial spirit and the social requirement of, you know, everybody has a right to housing. It's not a commodity. And that will be battled out on the floor of the House of Commons. In the short term, you know, there is this notion to revive our mills, to actually get our forestry sector, you know, working, milling our logs here, and from the forest to the mill, having good tradespeople jobs, building housing, affordable housing in our communities, in our northern communities.
This is Ian Gregg reporting for CIFA Radio's Due North on 88.7 FM.
This is a CHLY and CVOX news update. The election is in its final stretch on Vancouver Island, and with the right side of the Canadian political spectrum mostly consolidated within one party, many progressive voters are calling for strategic voting, a strategy to align votes with the most popular party on one side of the spectrum. In this case, the left. Political science professor Stuart Prest from the University of British Columbia explains instances where strategic voting may benefit voters in a first-past-the-post electoral system.
It works potentially when there is a close vote between two front-running parties and the voter in question has a clear preference between those two parties, even though there's a third party that they would, in a vacuum, prefer to see win.
He explains that in a hypothetical riding where Party A on the right and Party B on the left are neck and neck, and Party C, also on the left, is running a more distant third, then if a voter has a preference that the stronger left party win, they might vote for B even if their usual choice would be C. In our case, Party A would be Conservative, and Parties B and C would be parties like the NDP, Liberals, or Greens.
And that's the kind of scenario where it makes sense to engage in a kind of strategic voting. But if it's hard to say which of those two more progressive parties is more likely to win, if they seem like they're polling relatively closely within a given, and if it's at the level they're riding, you have to think. Or if you're just not sure which has a better chance of winning, because it's often quite hard to get a really good signal at the level of a single riding who is more likely to be ahead. And it doesn't really make as much sense. You're really just trying to guess what other people are thinking, and you're probably better off just voting for the party that you'd really rather see win.
Active community member and past Comox Valley Regional Board Director Arzina Hamir shared her own experience having run in the recent provincial election as a Green candidate.
In my own campaign, you know, I ran as a BC Green in 2024. We had, you know, a split between myself and the NDP, and, you know, splitting the voters did enable, you know, a Conservative MLA to be elected. So when it doesn't work, those are the consequences. You get a non-progressive being elected because the right is consolidated.
Hamir says that the 2024 provincial election had the unique opportunity for progressive voters to not fear splitting the vote between parties on the left, as there were also two parties running on the right, the BC Conservative and the BC United parties.
That was actually an opportunity for us to not have to vote strategically and to vote with your conscience. And that was so exciting until the United pulled out, right? And most of the votes then consolidated around one candidate on the right.
Hamir says she does not regret running and does not feel she should have pulled out of the race.
I ran a campaign absolutely thinking that I could be elected. And, you know, just by the number of volunteers and the amount of donations and the door knocking that we did, I thought we had the metrics and everything to get me across that finish line. But what ended up happening. People did have that fear come in, and they supported, you know, the older parties that they were more used to. But I ended up taking a few thousand votes away from the NDP versus the previous provincial election in 2020. And that was enough for the Conservative MLA to be elected. So, yeah, it's a pretty good example of what can happen if you don't have a strategic, if you've got a, you know, a right that's got just one candidate. And we had two when I began, so this was my hope. But when you just have one and then the left is split, yeah, that's what happens.
Hamir doesn't think that political parties and candidates should run or not run based on concerns of splitting the vote. However, in the case of the federal election happening right now, she feels that once polling is showing if it is clear that one party on the left is breaking the 30% mark, the others should make way for the stronger candidate.
Since nobody has pulled out and, you know, the campaigns are where they are in 2025, it would be really nice for one of the candidates to signal to the other, polling is showing I'm weaker and I'm going to encourage my voters to vote for you. Just, yeah, I think that would be such a hero move, and that candidate would be really regarded well in the community. And then moving forward, yeah, until we can reform the way that we vote in Canada, it's a tough call.
When speaking about electoral reform, Hamir made it clear that she feels we should have already moved to proportional representation by now.
It's really sad that the Liberal Party and, you know, and Justin Trudeau's kind of parting words was like he wished he had gotten proportional representation done. Well, hello. Why did that not happen? It was a promise of the Liberal Party, and they totally backed down from it. And I really don't understand, because I know the NDP wanted to support it, so the two parties themselves could have pushed that through. I think, you know, especially when larger parties get a majority in government, they have zero incentive to reform the way that the system works. And that's unfortunately what's happened back and forth in our parliament. And yeah, it just really has done a number on vote. And you see like lower and lower voter turnout because people don't feel that their votes count.
Professor Stuart Prest shared a bit of humor on the subject.
The joke I sometimes tell is that proportional representation in Canada will eternally be the choice of the party that finishes third. And that if you are, or if you're finishing first and you are in control of government, you don't really have a strong incentive to change the rules. And if you finish second, then, well, you're just a hair's breadth away from holding power yourself until you want to try again the next time around. And it's only if you are in third place or after that you might say that, well, maybe the way we count votes is not as fair as it could be.
No matter who you intend to vote for, General Election Day is Monday, April 28th, and polls will be open for 12 hours. Find your polling station and hours on your voter information card or through Elections Canada's Voter Information Service at elections.ca. For new voters, there is no deadline to register, and it can be done at the polling station before casting your ballot. To vote, you must be a Canadian citizen, at least 18 years old on Election Day, and prove your identity and current address. For CHLY and CVOX News, this is Heather Watson.
Today on CSK News, as we move into the final days of the 2025 federal election, we wrap up our candidate interviews with NDP incumbent Taylor Bacharach. Take a listen to all the candidate interviews at smithersradio.com under CSK News. General Election Day is Monday, April 28th. And be sure to tune in to live election coverage after the polls close on Monday evening to hear all the results from across the region and Canada. You're listening to CSK News, Smithers Community Radio.
Taylor Bacharach, I'm the incumbent NDP candidate in Skeena-Buckley Valley. And for the past 6 years, I've served as Member of Parliament in this beautiful part of the world. And right now, I'm just on the outskirts of Port Clement on Haida Gwaii.
All right, Taylor, thanks so much for being with us again on CSK News. Of course, it's the last few days of the federal election 2025. Maybe tell us a little bit about how the campaign has been going so far for you.
Well, I think it's been going really well. It's, you know, we've been putting in a lot of miles, trying to get to every corner of this huge riding and talking to people from all walks of life about this moment in time. Where Canada is facing some pretty extraordinary circumstances. The threats coming from the U.S. have really put people in a frame of mind where they're feeling a lot of apprehension, a lot of anxiety about the future. And I think, you know, they not only want Canadians to come together in the face of these unprecedented threats, but also to stand up for the things that we've built over time, the legacy that makes up our country. And so I've been having really important conversations about things like healthcare and pensions and, you know, climate action, you know, the things that people want to see going forward for their kids and their grandkids.
You know, Taylor, as you mentioned, you're the incumbent, and I remember quite often you talked about over the last number of years how the NDP and a minority government used their power to get some things done. What are some of those things that kind of stand out to you that you're trying to ensure don't get taken away in this election?
For sure. Well, just for a second, like looking back at 2021 and the election, it seems like 100 years ago, to be honest. But what happened, we were in the midst of the pandemic, and the Canadian public handed us basically the same parliament that they had voted in 2019, a minority parliament where no party held a majority of the power. And I talked to so many people in that election about what was happening, and they said, you know what we want? We want politicians to put aside their partisan differences for once, to work across the aisle and to get things done for Canadians, right? And so faced with that minority and thinking back to previous minorities in Canadian history, which have been some of the most productive parliaments of all, you know, we had a choice to make. And the choice that we made was to use our power in parliament, use our 25 seats to force the government to work with us on policies that the NDP has been championing for a long, long time, for decades. And so I'm so proud to be part of a small caucus that managed to bring in Canada's first national public dental care program. That program has already delivered care to over 1.5 million people. And next month, if the Conservatives don't get in, our hope is that it's going to be expanded to cover about 9 million Canadians who don't have insurance. That's huge. And everyone knows that dental care is health care, and yet so many people can't afford to go to the dentist. So that was a huge accomplishment, probably the most significant one. But also pharmacare. So right now, Canada is the only country that has universal health care but no pharmacare program. And so we were able to bring in Canada's first universal pharmacare legislation. Essentially, it lays the groundwork for a universal pharmacare program that follows the principles of the Canada Health Act. And British Columbia was the second province after Manitoba to sign on to that program. And so in about a year, people in British Columbia are going to have access. People living with diabetes are going to have access to free diabetes medication, insulin, test strips, all the supplies that they need. That's going to save people with type 1 diabetes $1,200 a month. That's tremendous. It's a life changer. And people who use hormone replacement therapies are prescribed hormone replacement by their doctor. Those costs are going to be covered as well. So eventually, we're hoping this is going to cover all essential medications in Canada so that every single person, when they go to the doctor, can afford the medication their doctor prescribes. It's really transformational. And then the final thing I'll mention, there is a long list of accomplishments. The final thing I'll mention is a national school food program. About $1 billion over 5 years, it's going to put nutritious meals in front of about 430,000 school kids across the country. And that's just so important. I think everyone knows the importance of that. Education is a great social leveler, but if you don't have food in your belly, you know, you can't learn. So those are some of the things I'm really proud of. And now we find ourselves at this juncture where Canadians have to choose between conservative cuts. The Conservatives don't believe in any of those things that I just mentioned. And in fact, they want to make our country look an awful lot more like the United States. And so people have to choose between conservative cuts and a vision of building on the legacy of folks like Tommy Douglas and building on the things that make Canada a really decent and good country to live in.
Okay, Taylor, we'll leave it there for now, but thanks again so much for your insight and thoughts on this, and good luck on the campaign trail.
Thanks so much, Dan. Good to talk to you as always.
And that's this week's episode of The Scoop, a podcast and broadcast featuring stories from remote BC by the journalists in the communities of Smithers, Cortez Island, Revelstoke, Kootenay, Prince George, and Terrace. This program was made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada and the Local Journalism Initiative Program. Tune in next week for another episode and follow us online wherever you get your podcasts.
Good day. You're listening to Free City Radio. I'm Stefan Christoph. Thanks for tuning in. This is edition 263. On the broadcast this week, I'm going to be sharing a conversation with Philadelphia-based organizer Hannah Mermelstein. Hannah has been involved in community organizing work to lift up and support Palestinian human rights for many years. I got to know Hannah's work in various contexts, organizing that took place within a network called Librarians for Palestine, and also work to bring community organizers from different communities around the United States together, and to see the connections between their work in support of Palestine and other social justice movements. I think Hannah's work is very important, and it was great to speak with Hannah about her organizing over this past year in the Philadelphia context, working with community organizations and families to speak out for Palestine. Here is my conversation with Hannah Mermelstein on Free City Radio. At this moment, there's quite a significant focus on Palestine in the news cycle, but there are many periods where Palestine is not a focus. And I mean, there's a particular intensity of the violence on the part of the Israeli state right now being directed at Palestinian people in the context of genocidal military actions in Gaza. But one thing that's come up is, you know, in a lot of conversations in the context of social movement organizing to support Palestine is how to sustain sort of organizing, how to sustain grassroots action. And today I'm speaking with Hannah, who's based in Philadelphia, who's been in a bunch of different cities. And, you know, you've been involved in doing this work for many years. So I thought it'd be interesting to sort of hear your perspective about this moment, but also how it's connected to sort of different lineages of struggle, both around Palestine and other issues, other struggles. So maybe we could just first start, if you could introduce yourself and share a bit about how the last months have been in Philadelphia and sort of any reflections you'd like to start off in sharing about the larger points that were brought up. Thank you.
Sure. So my name is Hannah Mermelstein. I am in Philadelphia. I grew up just outside of Philadelphia and was away from this area for many, many years. Moved back here 3 years ago, three and a half. And it's interesting what you mentioned about the cycles, the news cycles. Just because of the structure of my life, I've also had cycles. I didn't for many years. For many years, Palestine was my focus. It went in and out of news cycles, and it was my focus the entire time. I was spending a lot of time in Palestine, back and forth a lot between Boston, Brooklyn, the longest stretch was Brooklyn, and then just all over, and the West Bank, so kind of back and forth. And then I sort of shifted my work, and we can talk about that if you want to kind of go back to why I shifted out of delegation work, and then now I'm thinking about it again. You know, the BDS movement was growing. I was like, okay, my Palestine work is really more in the States now. Like, I need to go home and do that. I also started library school at the time, and I also shortly after that had kids a few years later. So that stretch, I was going to Palestine less, and then once I had kids, had not been back at all, was feeling kind of disconnected, and then also because of being a parent was, and then moving to a new city, my old city, but new city to me now, Philadelphia, I wasn't actually particularly involved during these past couple years. I wasn't actually particularly involved when I moved to Philly until October of 2023. And so I had sort of been a little bit less active, at least for those last couple years. And then you know, like many of us, I think, just drew me right back in. And there are many groups that have been doing work in Philly and elsewhere.